Hi, this is Rocky Suppinger. You're listening to the Yo Rocco podcast. My guest today is Marcy Auld Glass, the pastor of Southminster Presbyterian Church in Boise, Idaho. Marcy is a good friend of mine. She was elected yesterday as the co-moderator of the Covenant Network of Presbyterians. She is a very gifted writer, active blogger. Her stuff shows up on the Huffington Post with some regularity. And over the last several months, she's been involved in a couple of different political campaigns or maybe I should say issue campaigns in the state of Idaho regarding rights for LGBT folks, as well as reproductive health for women. And so I'm going to talk to her today about why she's involved in those things, why those particular issues, and why political involvement in that way. So thanks for being here. I look forward to the conversation. So thanks for coming on.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you, especially today. It's a pretty fortuitous day. Yesterday, my Facebook feed was full of all of these congratulations for you for being elected the co-moderator of the Covenant Network. So congratulations.
Thank you very much. I'm very excited about it. I was I was pleasantly surprised by the amount of people who were interested in that. It was, it was great.
You didn't think people would be interested in it?
I guess I was surprised that that many people still paid attention to things like church groups. So yeah, I guess a little surprised, but it was good. It was all good.
So that means that you had the honor of being elected as the moderator of the board of a church group that you thought nobody cared about anymore.
Well, a few people, but yeah, something like that.
Right. No, it was a little surprising. A little surprising to me as well. Was the election actually yesterday, or was it just announced yesterday?
It was just announced yesterday. The election was at the board meeting a couple weeks ago.
Okay. How long have you been on the Covenant board?
2 years, a little over 2 years.
Wow. And not everybody who listens to this podcast, all, of the five people who listen, there may be one who doesn't know what the Covenant Network is. So can you just, what's the elevator speech about the Covenant Network and why it's important?
Yes. The Covenant Network is a group in the Presbyterian Church who has been committed to making the church more just and more inclusive and more generous, and to do so from the center of the church, to try to include people from all ends of the church while at the same time being committed to seeking greater inclusion, particularly of gay and lesbian members of the church, but even more broadly than that, but always doing so with conversation and dialogue with people who disagree with us.
Okay, that's very well done. That's a good elevator speech. That can't be the first time you've given that.
No, probably not.
So what's going to be your first executive act as the co-moderator of the board? You going to get yourself a car?
I haven't really given much thought to my first executive action. I'm sure it'll declare something, some great world powers for me. But a car would be okay. I like my car.
You don't have them already.
The name people have to call me in public, something like that. I don't know.
Fair enough. Well, speaking of, great worldly power, this is actually the thing I wanted to talk to you about, was your involvement in stuff related to public decisions and public power and political power and that kind of stuff. So this podcast is really a way for me to talk to people who are undertaking interesting projects and interesting work, or at least interesting to me. And I've watched your writing about a couple of different issues that you've got involved in and testified before the State House there in Idaho and written very persuasively about on the Huffington Post and your own blog. So can you just say, kind of in a nutshell, what it is that you're working on in that sphere?
Sure. In the state of Idaho, which is all five of your listeners would know is a very conservative place, there has been a movement in place for the last 10 years that I've been a part of, probably the last 3 or 4 years, to try to add the words sexual orientation and gender identity as protected classes under the Idaho Human Rights Act. This movement is called Add the Words, and this year was the first year we've had a hearing even on a bill. It didn't make it out of committee, but that was still a huge step to finally get a hearing.
Right.
And so a number of gay and transgender Idahoans were able to share stories of the violence and that they face and the discrimination and the exclusion from society and all those things that many people, I think, just aren't aware of. I got plugged into it a couple of years ago because I realized that the church, if it was saying anything about the issue, and I mean the church very broadly, was
right.
saying very bad things about the issue.
And like what?
Well, they were saying that, no, my religion gives me the freedom to discriminate against you. My religion gives me the freedom to exclude you and to not welcome you into my restaurant and to not make you a wedding cake or to not, you know, whatever the situation is, to not rent you an apartment or give you a job. And I think that's antithetical, actually, to the gospel. And so just being present, standing with people in witness outside the Capitol in prayer and in protest, and doing so with my robe and stole on as visible signs of my office, ended up being a way for me to be present with people who were not being heard by the legislators and allowed conversation to happen for people who had only thought that the church was bigoted and hateful, quite frankly. So it also seemed the least I could do as a heterosexual white woman of privilege and comfort. I don't really know anything about that kind of discrimination or exclusion. It seemed the very least I could do to use my voice to try to advocate, especially in a state that would declare itself to really be led by Christian values.
Right.
I think it's important that gets sussed out a bit, that people have to really, okay, so what exactly is Christian about exclusion? You know, I mean, I think they need to defend themselves a little better than they've had to in the past. And I think it's kind of incumbent on us as Christians who care and who have privilege and who have a voice to speak out for people who don't have a voice.
It sounds like part of your goal with this was to force the issue in conversation with other Christians, not just political officials. Is that right?
Actually, partly with other Christians, but partly with, I actually probably care more about the people who have had to leave the church because they didn't think there was a place for them. And I've heard so many stories of people who have been kicked out of their churches for being gay or lesbian or who had to leave their church because their brother or their sister or somebody they loved was gay or lesbian, and have then just concluded that there was no place for them to worship and that God is a mean and vengeful and hateful person. And I think I probably care more about them, not so much expecting them to want to come back to church, although they certainly, some have, and many, you know, they'd all be welcome, but just so that they know that that there's another story out there about God and that there are other viewpoints and that the kind of conservative American Christianity is not monolithic and doesn't actually get to speak for God exclusively.
Do you see that, you know, that force that you're describing, you know, kicking people out of churches and this conservatism of the state where you live, do you see that getting more conservative? I mean, is it getting worse?
It does seem we're getting more polarized. I mean, Arkansas just signed a law today that keeps cities in the state of Arkansas from signing non-discrimination legislation. So they've actually now have enacted, encoded discrimination into their law, I guess, which I'm sure that can't stand, right? But
right, but like if that had existed in Idaho last summer, you guys couldn't have even brought that issue because it would have been illegal to tamper with it would have been illegal to add those kind of protections to begin with, right?
Right, and you know, interestingly, in a state as conservative as Idaho is, I think 10 cities now have passed non-discrimination ordinances, and not, you know, hotbeds of liberalism, as some people accuse Boise of being, but smaller towns out in the kind of hinterlands of the state. Numbers between, depending on the surveys you've read, 67% to 82% of Idahoans are in favor of adding the words. It's interesting that as it has gotten more polarized, I think it also is causing people to go, wait a minute, what are we doing here? So I think in the short term, things look pretty bad, and bad legislation is being passed, and good legislation is being set aside. But I think ultimately we're going to see a change, because I think most people aren't as ideologically hardline as the political parties seem to be right now. I think most people are really seeking something more in the middle and are not seeing it from their elected officials.
It sounds like you're actually hearing from a segment of the population that maybe is not represented in the conversation very often. That is, these folks who have been on the outside of this conversation, who've been, you know, alienated or downright excluded from their churches. Where are these conversations happening for you?
They happen at the Capitol, and they happen at the state Capitol.
Oh, at the Capitol, okay.
And when I'm, you know, standing out in front of the Capitol in prayer vigils or protesting, or when I show up at events that are where people don't expect to see clergy. But they also are happening when at the Pride Festival, for example. My church has been going to the Pride Festival in Boise for the last 4 years and apologizing to people who've been hurt by Christianity.
Apologizing, so how? It's like walking up to people and saying, we're sorry? Or what does that apology look like?
Some of us actually wear T-shirts that say, hurt by the church, get a straight apology here. And wow. And we just go around and ask if there's anything that Christianity has done that we can apologize for. And it's really interesting. Oftentimes,
was that your idea?
No, I wish it was my idea. I had shared a video in worship 5 years ago or so of a woman in San Francisco, I think, who was doing it. And some people loved the video that I shared, took it to the mission committee and said, we should be there. And so people from the church kind of pushed it forward. I mean, I totally supported it, but it kind of grew out of something else. But those conversations are interesting. People usually will say, no, you don't have anything to apologize to me for. I've never been Presbyterian. And you know, if they're willing to talk to you and you say, well, I bet somebody somewhere did something, and they say, well, yes, and then they tell you a story, and it's very sacred and very holy, and so we just try to listen to those stories and apologize, and then, you know, sometimes they'll just thank us and walk away, and other times they'll let us give them a hug or something, or pray with them or whatever, but it's really holy work.
These aren't conversations that are happening in church. Obviously, these folks aren't there. You're finding these conversations out in the community at these events.
Correct. Although the conversations do happen at church as well. I mean, sometimes because people, you know, see me or other members of my church testifying at the Capitol or protesting or whatever, they will come to worship. Or, you know, kind of hear about it through Facebook or my blog or whatever. And so sometimes those conversations do get to happen in church. But I was very clear with the congregation when they talked about going to the Pride Festival the first time. I said, this is evangelism for sure. This is taking, you know, God's grace and mercy to a place that the church has historically not been present. But we're not doing this to make more members of our congregation, that we have really uncoupled church growth from evangelism. If people want to come to our church, we certainly invite them. We have little flyers that tell them when worship is and all that kind of stuff. But our goal in being there is not to make our church a bigger place, but to let people know that God loves them.
And that was an easy sell for folks?
It was pretty easy. It took a bit of a mind shift a little bit, but they got it, and we had already done some similar things where we kind of walked through the neighborhood just to try to meet our neighbors, but not necessarily, to let them know about church, but not necessarily expect that they were going to come to our church, but to try to start conversation with the neighborhood. So right. They'd had a little bit of experience with that previously, and I think it's been a good change, because when you do uncouple church growth and evangelism, then it frees you to really just do what you're being called to do and not worry about what the bottom line is.
Right. It's the right thing to do regardless of whether or not it translates into increased church attendance.
Right. And, of course it has actually translated into increased church attendance, although not necessarily from the people who were, evangelizing or whatever.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, the people who have come to church, some of them are people we've met at Pride or Add the Words or whatever, but more of them are people who just have heard, oh, there's a church in the community that doesn't hate people and isn't that nice, and there's actually plenty, there's lots of us, but apparently that's the best kept secret in the world, right? So our church is growing, and not by leaps and bounds or anything, but we've got a lot of new energy and new excitement and people who are kind of committed to doing whatever God's calling us to do here. And so, the church is growing, but not because we knocked on doors or went to the Pride Festival necessarily.
I want to ask you about the first thing that you went to, the first time that you went to the State House. Even further back than that, are these the first instances where you have gotten involved in these kinds of public protests or legislative issues in a public way like this?
Yes and no. This is really the first time I've lived 10 blocks from the state capitol. This is the first time I've been kind of really actively involved that way, but my whole life I've sort of been a political observer. If you talk to somebody I went to high school with, they're wondering why I haven't run for president yet.
Goal.
Exactly. I got to meet President Reagan when I was in high school in the Rose Garden, and was
how did you get to do that?
I went to Girl State, and and each state handles it differently, but each state sends two people to Girls Nation or to Boys Nation or whatever. And in Washington, where I went to high school, you actually ran for U.S. Senate. And so I ran for U.S. Senate and won, and got to be a representative to Girls Nation. And so it was this great week. I was a junior summer after my junior year in high school. A week in D.C. With 100 women from, young women from all the states, and it was sort of like a political nerd slash Miss America conference.
Slash Miss America?
Yes, because...
There were a lot of pantsuits, weren't there?
No, there were a lot. Well, we had to wear dresses the whole time, and gloves and pantyhose and heels. I mean, because it was sponsored by the American Legion. I don't know if this has changed now, but
back so there was in the a dress 80s, code.
There was a dress code, and we had these name badges that had our state like a ribbon coming down. And so we're out public all over D.C., you know, with
as like, Miss Washington.
So, but, you know, we really just wanted to talk policy, but right. We you know, so it was, anyway, so I we got to meet President Reagan in the Rose Garden, which was my, and I wasn't a huge fan of his, even in high school.
But he's the president.
He was the president, and that was an impressive thing, and it was in the Rose Garden, and Nancy was, like, waved to us from a window in the White House because she was packing to go to Prince Andrew's wedding or some, I don't know, somebody was getting married. And
you know how it is.
So he, you know how it is. And so he had 100, you know, young women who were interested in the political process there, and he could tell us something that would really inspire us. And he told us when we turned 18 to register to be a Republican and to vote for the Strategic Defense Initiative to support Star Wars.
Oh my gosh, you're kidding.
No, and I was like, really? Like this, really? This is the best you've got? Like, this is how you inspire us to public service? And it was very disappointing.
Needless to say, you did not follow that advice.
No, I did not. But it was also my first opportunity to see somebody who was really larger than life, and I really understood his success in a way that I hadn't before, because he was just commanding. He just filled all the space, and you just wanted to be near him. He was this huge, larger than life, just so charismatic. I had a similar experience seeing President Clinton. You just got it when you saw him. As much as I am a fan of President Obama, he does not have that same experience or that same presence in public.
Really? That's funny because, I mean, but that's the thing that people, say about Obama is that he does have that presence. You haven't experienced that.
Yeah, I mean,
Have you met Obama too?
I mean, I have not met Obama, but I've been, you know, in rallies where he's been speaking and I've been up close. And he's a great speaker and he's a good, all of that, but he didn't have, Reagan and Clinton, just, it was a, I still can't really put it to words, just this presence that was so much bigger than everybody else around them. You know, and I mean, I liked one of those presidents and didn't like the other, so it's not just kind of politics.
Right, right. But, so this involvement, even in high school, in the political process and getting yourself elected as the state senator from Washington State, was that just a personal interest, or was that kind of in your family's DNA? Were your parents into that kind of thing?
Oh, God, no. My family voted. They were always, you know, participated in the political process, but I...
So why were you so into it?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question.
Rebellion.
A rebellion. I'm going to grow up and become a Republican. That would be rebellion, wouldn't it? You know, I think, actually, for me, and it's probably the same reason I became a pastor as opposed to becoming a politician, ultimately, is what I liked about politics and what I really value in being a pastor is the ability to speak for people on behalf of people who are not being heard. And I think ultimately at its best, that's what politics is about, kind of representing the polis, the people, right?
Okay.
And I don't think we see that today often. But I think that's what I like about it. And when, you know, interestingly, yesterday I was just at the State House when you may have heard one of our representatives asked if you
Here
could follow a pill and it would allow a gynecological exam. And the doctor said that he was questioning, said no, because if you swallow a pill, it won't end up in the vagina. Now, of course, today he's claiming that it was a rhetorical question and, you know.
Right, time, of course it was.
I'm sure it was. But, you know, somebody like that now gets to legislate women's health and will do it in a way that I believe is harmful for women and for Idahoans and for everybody in general. And
that comment, by the way, got picked up by a reporter from the Minneapolis Star Tribune, by the way.
I know, Rachel Maddow talked about it.
Oh, she did? Yeah, if you Google Idaho House Bill 154, that's one of the news stories that comes up about it, is the Minneapolis Star Tribune. And the headline is, Idaho lawmaker asks if woman can swallow camera for gynecological exam before medical abortion.
It's just, it was so awful, you know. And but what I thought yesterday while I was sitting there waiting to testify against this horrific piece of legislation was how grateful I was for the four Democrats on that committee who, in a single-party political system like the state of Idaho, those people are still willing to give their time to come and try to represent people, you know, in a state house that is so one-sided. And I have so much respect, and I live in the district that one of those representatives is in, and I'm so grateful for her. It just must be like spitting into the wind every day. Like, where is it going to go when
how divided
those
is
votes
it?
Are so party? Oh, it's I don't actually know what the numbers are, but it's not pretty. It's really
it's not. It's not even close.
No, not even close.
So what was it that you were? You said it was a horrific bill. What were you testifying against yesterday?
I went, as did another clergywoman, to suggest that there were other ways you could be pro-life rather than just passing restrictive anti-women legislation. And so I pointed out that if they really were concerned about these women who are facing these unplanned pregnancies, they could, you know, do things like raise the minimum wage, fund early childhood education and daycare, that they could make sure contraception is available, that they can make sure that sexual education is not abstinence only, that there are a number of ways that they could actually show the lives that are currently in the state of Idaho that they matter, and that it's not just we only care about you until you're born. The surprising thing actually was how stunned they were that there were Christians who would be speaking in favor of keeping abortion legal. I mean, they were just stunned. They just never even crossed their mind that
this was this is a committee.
Right, on the committee of the House. Yeah.
So what committee was it?
It's the House State Affairs Committee.
The House State Affairs Committee, and the bill actually wanted to what restrictions is it proposing?
It's about telemedicine and specifically related to medicines that you could prescribe that would induce abortions. So chemical abortifacients, basically.
Okay.
There are so many women in Idaho that don't have access to you know, major medical centers. They live in very small towns, and so telemedicine is a very kind of big component here, and this would keep that from being available through telemedicine, which would...
And it passed yesterday, right?
It made out of committee on a straight party line vote and will now go to the House.
Where it will probably pass, right?
Maybe. I'm hoping that this bad PR... from Representative Barbieri will actually get people riled up enough about it to actually contact their legislators. And, you know, I mean, there have been bad abortion bills proposed in the past pretty much every year here, and most of them have managed. I mean, it's still pretty restrictive here, but many of the even more restrictive bills have not made it. So who knows?
Okay.
We'll see.
So this one wants to make it so that you can't prescribe those some of those medicines over the phone. It requires a face-to-face visit with a doctor.
Right.
Okay. So why this issue? I mean, you talked about the Add the Words campaign and your convictions about that. Why? What motivates you to be involved in this one?
Well. Partly just because I'm a woman and I hate seeing legislation that is claiming to be concerned about the safety of women, in fact, just try to limit a woman's ability to control her own healthcare choices. And that, for me, is a very personal issue. I don't know how much time we have on this podcast, but
about 30 more minutes.
I was When I was in college, I got pregnant the first time I had sex, which is one of the reasons I suggested the legislators yesterday should pay attention to that non-abstinence-based sex education. It didn't really work very well for me.
Right.
and so when I found myself this unplanned pregnancy as a good, you know, I was a good Christian kid, right? This was not the plan. This was not what was supposed to happen.
Right.
And I was trying to figure out, what am I going to do? I'm, you know, I was a sophomore in college. I was not going to marry baby daddy. I will confess that I was very thankful that abortion was my choice and that I knew I could get one and it would have been legal. Interestingly, the most kind of compelling reason I had to get one was so the conservative Christian people who would judge me wouldn't know about me being pregnant out of marriage.
Right, you could keep it hidden.
I could keep it hidden, which is not a very good reason, although I understand why it works for some people. I had the privilege of knowing that my family wouldn't kick me out and they wouldn't, that I had financial resources and I was a student, so I didn't have a job that I was going to have to miss out on. So I had a lot of opportunities that a lot of women didn't have and don't have today. Mm. So I chose to place my son for adoption, and he's now 25 years old and wonderful. You got to meet him a couple months ago.
He's a delightful young man.
He's a delightful young man, and it's been an open adoption whole way, and such a gift and such a blessing, and I'm so grateful for it. But I remember that pain of sitting there thinking, good God, what do I do now? And it's such a difficult, horrible decision to have to make, whatever you decide to do, whether you decide to, you know, find a way to raise the child yourself or adoption or abortion or whatever. And to think that male legislators feel that they know better than a woman herself in the middle of that situation is just unconscionable to me. So that's an issue that's very personal for me. And also though is theological. I think there's another reason I'm probably a pastor is because when I was facing my pregnancy, I went to my pastor. I was about to join the church I went to in college, and I said to him, now's not really a good time for me to join the church after all. And he said, why not? And I said, it's just not. And then, like all good ninja pastors do, he just sat there and waited me out. And I just started
ninja
crying.
Ninja pastors.
he was so sneaky. And I started crying, and I sobbed, and I told him the whole sordid tale. And he turned to me, and he said, Marcy, when could you possibly need a church home and a church family more than you do right now? And I... you know, there it is. And so thank God for John Miller and University Presbyterian Church in San Antonio, Texas, for that and for that gift of welcoming me at a time that I didn't think I was worth welcoming, quite frankly. And I didn't think, and I wasn't sure I would get welcome from Christianity. In that church, they're a much larger congregation now, but at the time, you know, I'm sure that they were kind of scandalized by this pregnant teenager in their midst, but they never showed it to me, and they took me out to lunch, and they gave me maternity clothes, and they had me stand up on Mother's Day, even after I'd placed him for adoption, and just were so wonderful and kind and loving, and, you know, where would I be without those people? It was just so, so important. And so I think that the church, needs to be in those conversations and needs to remind people that there is no place you can go to flee from God's presence. And if you can't live your whole authentic life in the faith community, you're in the wrong faith community. You know, you need to be in a place where you can be yourself and you can be authentic and you can be broken and you can be in need of healing. And I think we still have a long way to go on that, but I'm grateful that, you know, I experienced it when I was in college and when I needed it the most.
Why do we have such a long way to go on it? I mean, why is that not more the norm?
I think sexuality is still such a problem for us. Not sexual identity, just the fact that we are sexual beings, you know, like there's, I don't know if it's what the Puritan ethic is still strong in us or whatever. We just don't want to talk about sex, and we don't want people to bring that brokenness. I think we do actually want people to bring that brokenness, but I think we're afraid if they really knew who I was, they wouldn't want me here.
That was your exact fear when you sat in John Miller's office, right?
Yeah.
Right. You said several moments ago when you were describing, you know, the reasons for getting involved in the Add the Words campaign, you said that, you know, as a white woman of privilege, you don't have any experience of this kind of exclusion, but you kind of do, right?
Sort of, maybe.
Is that not part of the motivation for you? You experienced the good end of this. You experienced how this is supposed to go.
Right. I mean, so, you know, I mean, and even at Trinity University, where I was a student, I went to the dean of students and told her what was going on, and she was like, "Okay, what do we need to do? How can we help you?" And just, my sorority, my friends, everybody just was there for me. And really, you know, if there were, a few people who kind of gave me looks, right, there were a million other people who, made sure I was eating enough and, wow. Stood next to me.
Trinity's a religious college?
It's a Presbyterian college.
Okay.
Actually, and so, you know, I could have experienced discrimination because of this, but I didn't. And partly that was maybe my own kind of forced will. but I had really good people around me, and so it didn't end up being a deal breaker kind of on any level. I had a lot of support and a lot of grace extended my direction. So,
yeah.
Even with that, I don't feel that I experienced much exclusion.
Okay. Well, it just seems to me that, I mean, having been through that experience, even just the possibility that you imagine, right, the worst case scenario you imagine of being shunned and cast out, it gives you a sympathy for a long, long time for people who are actually living that reality, right?
Right, that's true. And, I guess one of the privileges of an unplanned pregnancy is that, I mean, for all the stories that you hear about the girl who gives birth at prom and didn't know she was pregnant, I mean, by and large, you don't really hide pregnancy. It kind of walks right before you and in any room you enter. And so I had to deal with it pretty publicly. I couldn't, even if I would have tried to keep it a secret, I'm not sure how that would have worked. And so that was really a gift, I think, because I kind of recognized that I had to be able to look in the mirror at the end of each day and think, okay, you did what you could do. We'll try again tomorrow, and just get through it that way and not be so worried about what everybody was thinking about me. One of the other things I kind of learned about it was, not everybody's thinking about me all the time. even with that being such a public thing, I think so much of our other shame that we carry around in the church is not as public as mine was. Whether it's alcoholism or abuse or, a number of other things that we can hide better than I could have hidden a pregnancy. And, now, I haven't been pregnant with him for a very long time, but I still don't want to hide it because I, you know, he's just such a gift and such a wonderful person. I want everybody to meet him and know him, and you know, so I don't even want to hide it now. I don't, and yeah. I don't want anybody. I don't want my kids that I've had since Eric to feel. I never wanted them to feel like they couldn't talk about Eric. I didn't want that to be a shameful secret. I didn't want there to be secrets in the family, so we've been pretty public about it.
And they've met him?
Yeah. They have not spent as much time with him as I would like, but we just don't live in the same state, and you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But they have met him a couple times, yeah.
But even now, now that he's 25 years old, I mean, even the way that you're approaching it now and the openness that your family has about it, that's how you want that situation to go, ideally, right? I mean, it's exactly how you would draw it up.
Yes. Yeah, it's just been, it's been such a gift. His parents are, you know, such wonderful people and such wonderful parents. I mean, I kind of joked about sending my kids to them when they were, you know, like 9 or 10, just so she could finish them off, because she did such a good job raising Eric. And have been so gracious in kind of including me in Eric's life kind of all along the way. You know, I got to be there for his high school graduation and his college graduation, and when his older brother Greg got married, I got to be there for that. And so it's been a real gift.
So I can hear people, you know, that I've had conversations with about these kind of issues. I can hear them in my mind right now, and they say your experience with the church is great, and that's exactly how it ought to be. These issues ought to be instances where people experience the love and the acceptance and the grace of a faith community, but that doesn't mean that laws should change. You have taken a different approach. I mean, you're actively working towards changing laws. What do you say to that kind of critique that politics is a whole separate thing?
Yeah, we actually heard that a lot at the end of the Add the Words testimony. The Republican legislators who all voted against passing the bill on to the House said, you know, that we all need to be nicer people, and we all, you know, need to teach our children to be kinder, and you know, that my life's changed, I'll never be the same, I'm voting no. And it just felt so hollow, because if the reality is, you look around and we're a broken world, we're broken people who don't treat each other the way we should. And I think sometimes legislation can really lead and change behavior. Let's take same gender marriage, for example. Okay. In some places it's been legislated by states, but in other places it's been adjudicated by courts who have found that marriage bans are unconstitutional. And, you know, in Idaho, which got marriage equality in October, which was a huge surprise, really, that would ever happen in the state of Idaho, that had a constitutional amendment that had been passed maybe in 2006 or 2007, right before we got here, you know, banning it in the state constitution. And our governor is still trying to fight it to the Supreme Court right now, and he's not having much success, but God bless him for trying, right? But what I think people are recognizing with marriage equality is, oh, look, those people got married and my marriage is still fine. And, oh, look, the sky didn't collapse and, you know, fall around me. And, oh, look, I can still live my life the way with the same values I've always had, and nothing's changed. And so I think that people's viewpoints on marriage and marriage equality have changed just astronomically fast.
Yeah.
You know, 5 years ago, a whole different conversation than we're having today.
No, absolutely. And that the speed with which that's changed gives a lot of people pause, but it's also, you know, I think it's undeniable, right? And it's funny when you're talking about people's realization that, oh, the ground is not moving beneath our feet, this is not the end of the world. That's a kind of it comes from this concern for traditional marriage or biblical marriage that you saw and you wrote about with this private marriage chapel in Idaho called the Hitching Post. The legal issue that they were involved in, where they were refusing to do same gender marriages. And you did a ton of research into their business and what they do, and you wrote this great piece that got picked up by the Huffington Post, sort of skewering the whole notion that they care about biblical marriage because it's a for-profit business and they do thousands of weddings a year. And I mean, did you actually talk to them, or did you just find all that stuff online?
Actually, I found that stuff online, and I found it on both in their website and in their brief that they filed trying to get an injunction. It's interesting. Their brief that they filed was a complaint in search of a problem that didn't actually exist. They're operating as a nonprofit. You know, there's already exemptions for religious organizations in the state of Idaho, so there was never going to be any compelling of them. Nobody had any interest in compelling them to do anything, and so they filed this injunction before anybody really cared about what they were doing.
As a preemptive kind of move.
As a preemptive strike, we're going to just, you know, put it out there. And in the brief they filed, they mentioned that they had done over 35,000 weddings in 20, and then I looked online and they've been in business 25 years. And I thought, wow, you really have the sanctity of marriage really at the core of what you do, because, you know, you're marrying 1,500 couples a year or whatever it breaks down to. You know, when I do a wedding, and I'm sure when you do as well, like, I've got premarital counseling that I do with them, and we talk through things, and they do these inventories, and we spend a lot of time, and okay, how are you going to handle the first Christmas, and what's going to happen when the traditions all collide,
and
talk about finances, and how are you going to talk about kids, all that stuff, right?
The things you have a responsibility to do, right,
when you're signing on the marriage license, and, you know, just so the fact that they've got this wedding mill going through there, and the pictures of the chapel from their website are just atrocious. There's one that has like a gun hanging on the wall. I'm like, oh, quite frankly, I'm like, any gay couple that wants to get married there, really, you're on your own. I mean, really, I don't know what to tell you.
Are you saying the gun decor is not a prevalent thing in gay weddings?
Well, maybe. I mean, maybe there's a subculture that I'm just not aware of, but they could have handled it so easily by just bringing in somebody like me to do the weddings, and but they just had to make a big point. And
yeah, well, I love the piece that you wrote about it. My favorite paragraph, I'm going to quote directly from it. The Knapps are the name, that's the name of the people who own it, and you wrote, this is from the piece that got picked up on the Huffington Post, that I fully support the Knapps in their decision to personally officiate at weddings, to personally officiate at weddings that violate the sanctity of marriage. And clearly, by marrying only 35,000 couples, they have maintained a high scrutiny in their standards. I thought that was a great line.
Thank you.
You're a good writer.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's talk about that just with the rest of the time that we have. You are doing this. You're doing this legislative work and protesting and doing all this stuff, but you're also writing about it. I mean, the only reason I know about this stuff is because you're writing about it. So, what have you always been a writer, or has this work kicked that writing kind of into high gear for you?
I've always been interested in writing and, have enjoyed writing and thought about someday writing books or whatever. And preaching really has helped sort of oddly make me think that that's a possibility for me. A book seems kind of daunting. And then my husband pointed out a while back, he said, you know, you write a book chapter every week when you write a sermon. You know,
you could
do that. And that was kind of a helpful reminder. And my blog, I started about 6 years ago when I got here to the church. And honestly, I just wanted to have a place where my sermons could live in case I lost my files, like they'd all be in one place, and you know, maybe my mom would want to read them or something. And
MarcyGlass.com, by the way.
MarcyGlass.com. And so I started it really kind of with that place of being a repository for my sermons to live somewhere, but I didn't really expect that people would read much. And but I did get sort of a extra community of people who would never really come to church for some of the reasons we'd mentioned earlier, or who don't live in Boise or whatever, so they wouldn't come to my church, but who, you know, read my sermons every week, and for whom there's sort of a, so I have my congregation I serve here in Boise, which is a wonderful place, but I also have these people who, for whom I'm their spiritual person, meaning that I get messages on Facebook all the time from people who say, you know, will you pray for my uncle, or I'm, you know, like I'm their go-to person for any kind of faith thing. They don't, it's been sort of an interesting development for me. But then the writing about other things that were not my sermons seemed to be what really got more traffic on the blog, and so that's been a blog. I don't know how you feel about your blog, but for me, blogging kind of feels like such a exercise in narcissism. Like, look at me, I'm writing, and you have to read it. And there's so much traffic and whatever on the internet that's just vapid and wasteful that I don't want to be that. Feel somehow in blogging that it's by definition a little bit like that, and you have to promote it yourself.
It has to be.
So I'm a little uncomfortable with that.
Well, I've gotten to the point, if I can give you some peace about this, where I'm not uncomfortable about it anymore. I used to blog sort of irregularly with that same kind of anxiety about, like, who cares what I think about, you know, Facebook or whatever else. Right. But I've become a devotee of Seth Godin, and you know, he's somebody who just is on this mantra all the time about you need to be shipping your work every day. And by shipping, he means, you know, putting it out there. No matter what it is that you do, if you're a pastor, if you're a writer, if you make widgets, whatever it is that you do, you're not just making it to make it. You have to put it out there in the world for it to be judged. And if you're not doing that, then you're kind of hiding. And so I read that enough times that 6 or 7 months ago, I decided, okay, I'm gonna try to write something on my blog not every day, 5 days a week, Monday through Friday, and just not worry about what people, not worry that people are gonna think I've got a big head or whatever. Like, and it's interesting because I'm sure you found this as well. It's surprising the things that people want to talk to you about. It's surprising the things that you post that generate conversation, right? That you really didn't think was going to do that. You thought, well, I'm the only person who really is interested in this thing. But, you know, I had a conversation with somebody a couple of months ago who has a blog post I wrote taped on their desk. And I thought, and I was like,
that's humbling, isn't it? Yeah.
It's absolutely humbling, but it's also instructive because I did not write that thinking this is going to be so powerful and so great that people are going to tape this to their desks. I wrote it as kind of like a thought exercise and put it out there, and what do people think, right? And I think the way you write, I mean, you clearly spend a lot of time with the pieces that you write. They're carefully constructed, and I mean, you're very careful with the language. That's why they're so good. And they're on the Huffington Post, right? I mean, so they have a much wider public who's actually seeing them. So don't worry about that stuff. We love reading what you write.
I mean, clearly I don't worry about it because I still have a blog. At some level I've kind of come to terms with it. But it is I wrote a book chapter, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago for a book that is called Keeping the Faith. I should know what it's called because I'm in the book.
You probably know what your chapter's called.
I'm looking at my bookshelf. It's Keeping the Faith in Seminary. It's a book by Keeping the Faith in Seminary. And I was one chapter in that book. And writing writing that chapter and sending it off to an editor, though, was such a different experience for me, and I've had that a few other times now with other things that I've published. There's something about, you know, you can put it on your blog, and if people like it, great. And if they don't, it just sort of, you know, goes down the list, and nobody really knows.
It's not hurting anyone.
But sending something off to an editor was such a, I just felt so exposed in a way that I don't on my blog. And, you know, when they wrote back, like, love it, it's great, I just about passed out because, you know, I don't know. So it's an interesting process, too, to write that's not for a blog, to write where somebody else is kind of mediating it. I kind of felt the same way, actually, when I sent something off to Pilgrim, you know, for you and Landon, just like, oh, what if they hate it? And so it's, I think it's good for me to sometimes be edited.
Yeah.
Well, but I recognize how much of my life I don't have to be edited. I can do my own thing and move on.
Well, and the power of the editor, the power of an individual who simply by their title has this presumed expertise in what you're doing still carries a lot of weight. I mean, you can publish something on your blog that has there's no mediation between you and the entire world that is connected to the internet. Like, literally, everybody can find it. Everybody can trash it. Everybody can whatever. Yet, that's not as nerve-wracking as sending it to one individual who has the title of editor.
Isn't that crazy? That's so true.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and I was the editor of my newspaper in high school. Mm-hmm. And so I love being an editor for other people, and I'm pretty good at it. I'm pretty good at helping people. Like, well, that might be good in another sermon, but that's not what you're writing about in this sermon or that kind of stuff. I love being an editor as well. I don't do it as much as I used to, but it's another thing to be edited.
Yeah. No, I found that too when Landon and I did Pilgrim that you mentioned a second ago. I actually, that process was great for me because I realized how much I enjoyed editing. I mean, that is taking something that somebody is trying to say and helping them say it as clearly as possible, right? Sort of saying, this sentence, this clause is not actually helping what you're trying to do, so you can do without it, or, you know. I love doing that as well.
Yeah, and I think actually probably the pieces that I've written that are the best and the strongest, I've written with the voices of previous editors of mine kind of in my head. One of my college English professors was just very, you know, I hated turning papers into her because she would just destroy them. But she made me a much better writer. Chuck Campbell was my preaching professor. He was a really good editor. It was brutal to go through it, but I'm a much better preacher from him. And so those, I think the things that I do that are better are done because I'm very kind of, I can hear that voice in my head like, nope, you don't need that sentence, let it go.
Do you think that we're kind of in an era now where there are so many ways to communicate, and the barriers to getting an audience and cultivating an audience who care about what you're writing about, those barriers are almost entirely gone. Do you think we're in an era now where, you know, you just have to put the stuff out there? And I mean, like, think about a pastor's relationship with a church. It seems to me like we've depended on congregations to be our editors in some ways, right? Like this is the platform through which we do our work with this community, and we preach the sermons at this worship service at this congregation, and that's where it lives. But you have done this work now where you're going to the state capitol and you're putting your own name and face out in public on television, right? As Marcy Glass, and your congregation knows that you're from there, and it probably says that under your name, but still it's you, right? So I don't know, there's a question in there somewhere about a certain kind of independence that pastors have maybe now more than in earlier eras to write, to communicate, to take on projects, you know, with the support of their congregation, but those projects don't necessarily always have the congregation as their primary frame of reference. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It's interesting, though, because I hear often from people like, oh, you're so lucky to be able to say what you say, I would be fired from my church if they knew what I really thought.
Yeah.
Or if I said any of those things publicly.
And maybe
that's true. Maybe there are churches that would fire their pastors for doing what I do. I think, however, there are also many cases where the churches really are longing for somebody to really say what they feel and what they mean and to mean it. And often I think we shortchange the people we serve by not trusting them with what we really believe. My congregation, by and large, completely supports this Add the Words work. There's been a kind of the visible sign for Add the Words has been people standing in front of the courthouse with their hands over their mouth, kind of indicating what it is to be silenced by the legislature. Last year, some people who'd been active in the human rights work at the church invited the congregation to take a picture for that. And it's on my Facebook page somewhere and on my blog, but a hundred and some people after worship went outside and stood by the church sign with their hands over their mouth. I mean, it was a huge show of support from the congregation, just really wanting to actually be visibly involved in something like that. So I think on some level, I do have a great privilege to have a congregation that's willing to let me be who I am. But I think there are probably also places where the churches really want their pastors to be who they are. And that's not to say that hasn't been without controversy along the way, but...
Yeah, of course.
You know.
I enjoy that same kind of relationship with the congregation I serve as well. And the funny story that I always tell people about how that, you know, kind of the genesis of that was in the interview process. I was writing a blog. I was, I was looking for a call and had been without one for about 6 months when we moved to California. And I had an interview with a few people from the committee at this church. And I went home and I wrote about it on my blog. It was a phone interview, and I wrote on my blog about phone interviews and how it's such a weird thing, isn't it? It was pretty innocuous, but I wrote about it publicly, and then the next step in the interview process was this dinner with like three members from the committee, and the first thing the chair of the committee said to me was, "We saw your blog," and I was mortified. This was like in 2007. I thought, "Oh my gosh, what have I done? Why did I not,
consider the church again?"
Yeah, and of course, the teenager on the committee was the one who'd found it and shared it with everybody, and they right. But it forced this conversation even in the interview process about, are we comfortable with somebody who is going to be expressing a personality and public points of view out in the world, right? That people may not agree with, right? And then the really, really cool thing about the person I work with, Karen Sapio, is that she and I then had coffee just to kind of get to know each other a little bit before, I mean, that was like the next step. And we're sitting at this coffee shop and she says, so I heard from the nominating committee about your blog. And then she stopped and she looked down and she wrote something on a little like scrap of paper on the table and she slid it across to me and she said, "That's my blog address." And she says, I won't deny that I have it, but the congregation doesn't really know that I have it. I mean, she hasn't kept that blog up for the last several years, but it was just this great sense of like, okay, well, this is a congregation where this is going to be an okay thing to do, at least an okay conversation to have. But like you, I talk to people who are terrified of what their congregation would do or think if they really said what they thought out in public, right? I have a friend who's got these really beautiful tattoos and never wears short sleeve shirts because he doesn't want the congregation to know that he has them.
Right. Yeah, and it's funny because I think there are people who think that they can live separate lives, that I'm on Twitter, but nobody in my congregation knows it's me, and so I can say what I want about my congregation. Or people who like aren't friends with anybody that they know from church on Facebook,
right,
for example. And like, more power to you. I try to figure out how to navigate that, and I just couldn't do it. I was like, I just so kudos to them. But I think in the world we're in, as you talked earlier about all the barriers kind of coming down, I don't think we're going to be able to keep those separate lives up for much longer.
Right.
It seems like, you know, we are who we are, and it's, you know, I kind of, you know, talk to my children about, okay, so I noticed your friend was dropping a lot of F-bombs on Twitter the other day, and so, just so you know, like, you know, people are going to look at your Twitter handle when you apply for a job. So
right.
You know, be yourself, but recognize that if yourself involves a lot of swearing, you may not get the job you want. You know, so kind of teaching people to live in this age of public, you know, I don't know. I think it's interesting when people think they can keep it completely separate and compartmentalized.
Yeah. Well, I think you're doing a really nice job of you know, writing in a public forum in a really persuasive, compelling way that, I mean, as you've said, people are tracing back to your congregation in a way that's good, right? I just encourage you to keep that up. And I mean, I have nothing to do with your congregation, but I love reading what you write, and I love reading about the, you know, the advocacy work that you're doing, and you're writing about what you're learning. So I really appreciate you being willing to talk to me and coming on the podcast. Good. Well, now you have one under your belt. It's going to be a circuit. You're going to just like be on every Presbyterian pastor's podcast, like all three or four of them.
Exactly. Book them in the next month. We should just have one, so that we'd have more than five people listening, right?
Right. Just have one, but I'm in control of it.
Right. That works.
Everybody okay with that? Cool. All right. Good. All right. Thanks a lot, Marcy.
Take it so. Thanks. Take care.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.